Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Thank you. Good morning. Today on the Prison Radio Show, we'll be sharing an audio recording of Kenneth Hartman's piece from December 2014 called Christmas in Prison. The piece was originally published in last year's December 2014 issue of Harper's Magazine. Today we'll also be airing an interview with Tania Dubois-Goudreau from the group All Prisoners Are Political. Tania talked to us about conditions in Tanguay, the women's provincial prison here in Montreal. But first, some news items.
The Globe and Mail published an article on December 22nd called Solitary Confinement at Federal Prisons in Decline. The article quotes the Correctional Services Canada as saying that it has cut the number of inmates housed in long-term solitary confinement by more than 50% since March. The article went on to say, in a rare interview, a senior administrator at CSC told the Globe and Mail that the reduction is part of an agency-wide effort to reduce the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons that began 2 years ago with the release of 104 reform proposals arising from the coroner's inquest into the death of Ashley Smith. CSC granted the interview after a Globe and Mail story on Tuesday cited criticism of recent amendments to a regulation covering administrative segregation. The correctional service practice of confining prisoners for up to 23 hours a day in a cell no larger than a compact car. The Globe and Mail article went on to point out that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has endorsed the recommendations of the Ashley Smith coroner's inquest, urging his justice minister to implement all recommendations concerning solitary confinement and the treatment of offenders with mental illness. Those recommendations called for far more than statistical reductions. They proposed placing hard limits on the amount of time an inmate can legally spend in solitary confinement, 15 days in a row, up to a maximum of 60 days in a calendar year. The article went on to point out that the new government will face obstacles from the current CSC leadership in implementing these recommendations. The article quoted Julian Falconer, the lawyer who represented the Smith family at the coroner's inquest. Mr. Falconer said, "The presence of Commissioner Don Head as deputy commissioner or commissioner right through the circumstances around Ashley Smith's death, right through the endless cover-up and grief the family was put through by CSC, through the inquest, and now through this intransigence for 2 years after the inquest, makes clear that the commissioner is part of the problem." Mr. Falconer also said, "In my opinion, any political leadership that is looking to actually implement serious change would be wasting tax dollars if they put Mr. Head in charge of that change." According to an article on 325.nostate.net, prosecutors have requested 44-year sentences against anarchists Monica Caballero and Francisco Solar, who are accused of carrying out a bombing in Spain. The article says that the prosecution has demanded 9 years for belonging to a terrorist organization, 12 years for causing ear damage to a victim, 18 years for a terrorist attack, and 5 years for conspiracy to commit similar attacks. The article ends by saying that, quote, "The threat of stratospheric sentences is nothing new to the comrades. At the trial for the Casabombas in Chile, the prosecutor's request was 20 years for Monica and 25 for Francisco. It won't be the threat of years in prison made by the Spanish state that will stop insurrection or the will to struggle." You can find out more information about Monica and Francisco on the website of the Women's Coordinating Committee for a Free Walmapu. The website is wcctoronto.wordpress.com. Two anarchist prisoners in Turkey ended a 39-day hunger strike on December 20, 2015. Osman Evkan and Hasan Sinar were protesting the complete lack of vegan food in the prison, as well as strip searches being conducted by prison guards and conditions in the visiting room. They were also protesting the authoritarian terror, oppression, and violence faced by Kurdish people, sexist oppression and violence against women, imperialism, violence against migrants, and depredation of the earth.
Mumia Abu-Jamal had the final hours of her preliminary injunction hearing on December 23rd, 2015. Dr. Paul Noel, the Chief Medical Officer of PA Department of Corrections, stated on the stand that the affidavit filed in this case with his signature was not his testimony. According to prisonradio.org, Dr. Noel testified to the fact that the prison was not following protocol in Mumia's case. Others testified that Mumia deserved to be treated. Final briefs for the injunction are due in 6 weeks.
The time is presently 11:09 a.m. You're listening to the Christmas Day special of the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. This next piece is an audio version of Kenneth E. Hartman's piece, Christmas in Prison. The piece first appeared in Harper's Magazine in December 2014.
Christmas in Prison, Greeting the Holidays in an Age of Mass Incarceration, by Kenneth E. Hartman. Right after Thanksgiving, red and green decorations start popping up all over the place. The ubiquitous security windows with their diamond pattern wire reinforcements are suddenly framed in sparkly silver tinsel. It's 1980, and this is my first Christmas in the joint, in an adult lockup. Everyone who knew me before I entered prison has disowned me. I'm too young to fully grasp what that means. Tony Huber lives up in the Big Bird Bath cell, so-called because it was once a shower room. Back in the 70s, when the race wars raged hot and bloody, many bodies were discovered in these showers, which were not visible from the guard station. They have since been converted into reward cells, offered to the guys with the most seniority on the wing. Relative to every other cell, the Big Bird Bath is huge, with a tile floor and a window twice or three times the size of the regular ones. For the holidays, Tony has all of his Christmas cards taped up on his cell wall. There are several dozen, and they're carefully arrayed, marching from one corner to the next. All the traditional motifs are on display. The Santas and the elves, the trees and the wreaths, the fancy calligraphy with its exaggerated serifs. The old lifers, now in their 40s or 50s and covered in faded tattoos, have similar displays of holiday cheer. Wreaths appear in cell door windows, handmade Christmas trees are propped up on desks, loud flecks of color are everywhere and stand out against the institutional tans and pale greens. I notice that some of the guards even have candy canes poking from their uniform shirts. It's all new to me. On the walls of my cell I hang nothing. I receive no cards, nor do I send any out. I pass the time reading Nietzsche and sharpening shanks on the concrete floor. Some nights I do 1,000 push-ups trying to dissipate the energy. Some nights I lie on my bunk confused, overwhelmed by the life I've thrown away. At some point during the holidays, amid the oddly disconcerting peals of seasonal cheer, I'm talking with Joni Ramirez. He's 22, only 3 years my senior, and easier to relate to than the dinosaurs with decades strung out behind them. Next month I've got 4 down and only a couple left, he tells me, as if he were relating what's for dinner or what crummy movie will be flickering on the chow hall wall next weekend. I think, 4 years in the joint? That's a long fucking time. I can't imagine doing that much time. My first Christmas in prison and I'm living in a state of idiotic denial. I've been sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. I was among the first to receive such a sentence in California. It's so new that the prison system doesn't know what to do with me. For want of a better solution, I got sent to Soledad, a traditional gladiator school designed primarily to inculcate young men into the prison way of thinking, into the prison way of conducting oneself. I readily embraced this bleak and oversimplified lifestyle. I'm ready to become one of the legion of living dead inside the miles and miles of chain link that separate what is in here from what is out there. But what of all those cards? A year later, it's Christmas at Folsom State Prison, a vast granite tomb whose guards, with their rifles cradled in their arms, look to have been whisked off the set of Deliverance. I'd been thrown out of Soledad, where my youthful lack of fear and my sentence of forever had made me a problem. The moment I arrived at Folsom, I was placed directly into solitary confinement. The administration had explained I was too young to be released into the mainline prison and decided to keep me segregated for almost another year until I turned 21. Now I'm finally out of the hole and old enough to legally drink. No matter that I've been drinking since I was 13, the older guys have decided that I need to get drunk on this special birthday. Out of one of the steel drums that serve as trash cans comes a powerful brew, thick and fruity. I drink lustily, seizing this moment out of time, registering all of it in my memory. An ancient convict with a beat-up guitar, whom everyone calls Cowboy, is summoned to sing Mama Tried, a prison classic by Merle Haggard, one of the few country singers who actually served time, as opposed to the many who like to pretend they did. I have lived out the lyrics to this song since my days in the California Youth Authority. I turned 21 in prison doing life without parole. I should sober up at this chilling line, but I sing it out loud with the raucous chorus of drunken thugs around me. Under the multicolored roof of one building, believed to be the largest freestanding cell block structure in the United States, there are as many as 1,200 inmates crammed into 600 cells, each too small for even one man. Old Folsom has its own cadre of dinosaurs, and these are of the flesh-eating variety, all sharp teeth and slashing claws. I don't expect to see too many cards taped to the walls here. There is an embrace of nihilism, a ferocious grip on the ropes pulling us all down into the abyss. Around the second week of December, an enormous tree appears at the top of the cell block, over the central stairway, decked out in tiny blinking lights and with a brilliant silver star at its apex. It arrives suddenly, as if by magic. The top of the cell block exists in a separate dimension, like the permanently banned back stairs and the spiderweb of rickety steel spans that seem, from our vantage point in the yard, to pop out of the sides of buildings and disappear again. At night, after the last lockup, when all the cells are secured and the 150-foot-long deadlocks are heaved into place, I can see the reflection of the tree's lights twinkling in the arched windows. On Christmas Eve, gifts are distributed to one and all, to the naughty and the naughtier. A paper bag is dropped in front of my cell. My cellmate, Al DeMarco, from the San Fernando Valley, tattoo artist extraordinaire, who's 10 years my senior, pulls the goodies in when the guard comes by to crack open the door. Inside, we find candy, nuts, cans of soda pop, a couple of oranges, combs, and address books from the Salvation Army, and some writing paper and envelopes. At the very bottom is a Christmas card with a picture of a tree on it, and a standard holiday greeting inside. Al tosses the card onto the small metal locker that sits at the end of the bottom bunk. It's the only card that will enter this cage. I make a ceremonious attempt to stand it upright on the locker near the iron bars that front our home, but it keeps falling every time people walk by, blown down by their wake. It ends up on top of the locker at the foot of the bed, and stays there until after New Year's Day. In 1985, at the start of the greatest crime crackdown and prison expansion in U.S. history, California built its first new maximum security facility up in the Tehachapi Mountains, the spine of rock and forest due north of Los Angeles that stymied the railroad barons for several years. The bus ride to the place follows some of the old switchbacks before pulling up to the low buildings. With their long, uninterrupted horizontal lines, they have a denuded quality. All barren functionality and no charm. I arrived that same year, just before Halloween, a holiday that has yet to come into its own in mid-1980s prison culture. The weather is unsettled, alternating between hot and windy and cold and windy. The joke on the yard is that this is the land of four seasons, all in one day. I've come to Tehachapi in pursuit of the one thing I could never buy on the tier back at Old Folsom. In the depths of my isolation and self-imposed banishment, a woman has come into my life and brought love to me in a way that transcends everything else I've ever known. I met her through the happy accident of a random phone call from deep inside the Supermax unit of the Los Angeles Men's Central Jail. In the course of taking down a message from my lawyer, a receptionist with a strong musical voice wondered about my situation. "What's jail like?" she asked ingenuously. I gave her one of my well-rehearsed, stoic responses and hung up. But when the echo of her voice wouldn't leave me alone, I had to call back. I described the encounter to the less evocative voice that answered, and the reply was, "That must be Anita." At Tehachapi, I'm out in the visiting room with Anita every weekend, and as the holidays approach, I assume the decorations will go up, the candy canes will appear on the tables, the tree will be erected in a corner. But nothing of the sort ever happens. Not even in the visiting room, the one place where the bleakest of prisons usually allows the season to seep in. At the old places, there was a tacit agreement between the guards and the prisoners. Whatever I could sneak into my cell short of a gun or explosives was mine to keep. Ovens, toasters, fish tanks stocked with all the exuberance of the tropics. But in this architectural nightmare, this cathedral of isolation, there is no such agreement, tacit or otherwise. Cells are ransacked constantly, and nothing attracts the attention of a new guard more, nor raises his ire more effectively, than personalization. Anyone who makes the mistake of displaying Christmas cards on the walls of his cell will return from the yard to discover them torn in half, strewn about the floor, or floating in the toilet. I don't, of course, have some sort of divine right to a free man's Christmas. Not long after my 19th birthday, after a long night of heavy drinking and hard drugs and a couple of bloody brawls, I killed a man named Thomas Allen Fellows in a fistfight that he never stood any chance of winning. By that time, I had already been hardened inside Los Angeles County's notorious juvenile halls, one of the tens of thousands of broken and discarded boys and girls cast down into Mother California's youth prisons. I had aged out of the system and was wholly incapable of functioning without some kind of restraint, mechanical or otherwise. I knew too well the pain of loss and separation. The world on the other side of the fences seemed more alien to me than the world of brutes and brute force I had become accustomed to, had become part of, and which lived inside me wherever I went. Still, I am not an innocent. I did kill another man without any rational justification. The fault is all mine. The holiday fast approaches, and nothing in the nature of an official acknowledgement from the Tehachapi administration is forthcoming. No trees, no tinsel, nothing. The meaning of this irrational hostility becomes apparent late at night on Christmas Eve, when the third watch switches out with the first. The administration has installed a state-of-the-art public address system, with metal speakers bolted up into the corners of each section. Now a booming voice crackles out at us, "Just so you motherfuckers know, I'll be spending Christmas with my family, eating a good meal, and you'll all be here right where you belong." The speaker goes on ranting about how happy he is that all of us will be suffering while he's celebrating. When he finally runs out of spleen, he finishes with a hearty, "Merry fucking Christmas." We all recognize his voice. We know who he is. A huge slab of a man with unfortunate misshapen features and an aura of violence about him. And nobody is surprised. And while he isn't bright enough to articulate it with any finesse, he is accurately aping the new philosophy of corrections that is taking over American prisons. It's a more aggressive approach to crime and criminals that holds rehabilitation to be both pointless and fruitless. At this juncture in history, it's mostly an attitude, not a working mandate, but it will eventually imprison numbers so vast as to be unthinkable. All it means for now is that our own culpability for being in this place will be driven home to us every moment of every day, especially on holidays. Merry fucking Christmas indeed. It's 1995, and I have been at Tehachapi for more than a decade. It's my 11th Christmas in the mountains, and nothing has changed. There won't be trees or lights or any of that. Not here. Not in the state's securest mainline facility. That last bit is the propaganda of the institution. We all know it's bogus. The truth is a bit less stark. Not long ago, one guy donned a guard's uniform and literally walked out the front door. And the worst of the worst, as the corrections department likes to put it, had been shipped off to the infamous Pelican Bay State Prison, which opened in 1989. But Tehachapi is still as hostile and denuded a location as it was on the day that I arrived. On the other hand, I've changed. I've been clean and sober for years. I don't even smoke cigarettes anymore. More important, I no longer carry around the old hatreds, and my lovely wife is pregnant with a girl. Back at Folsom, the canteen sold candy canes and chocolate-covered cherries during the month of December. It was a tradition that stretched back to the days of Machine Gun Kelly. Even better, you could get eggnog. I decided to push for the canteen here at Tehachapi to sell that quintessential holiday beverage. I send a request for interview form, prisons love forms, to the canteen manager, asking him to sell eggnog in December only. I never get a response. Weeks go by before I see him walking across the yard. When I ask about my request, he tells me it's impossible. "What would the victims think?" he asks me. "I don't know," I reply. This is the first time I'm confronted directly by the prison industrial complex's self-defined rationale and all-purpose excuse. It's a mantra that will be repeated over and over until it becomes the central pillar upon which the edifice of endless punishment is constructed. It informs the thought process of the prison doctors who refuse to actually treat patients in need, of the prison teachers who refuse to actually teach their students, of the guards who shoot to death prisoners engaged in simple fistfights. My pregnant wife poses a tricky moral dilemma for these people. She's always been easy to vilify for her obviously improper consorting with the likes of me, and on account of that alone, she's been mistreated and disrespected for years. She has never hung her head. She always stands up for herself and, more to the point, for me. She wills me to be a better man with the ferocious power of her love, which becomes a shield that repels the ugliest of them. I know it costs her dearly, and I'm aware of how much she's depleting herself to rebuild me. But what of the life she carries within her? For years I've observed the miserable plight of my fellow prisoners' children. It's never failed to cause me great discomfort. Yet I've somehow managed to become a magnet to these kids, who spend too much of their visiting time talking with me at our table. I suppose they come around because it's obvious how much Anita and I love each other, or because we're both young and laugh out loud. At Christmas, the indignities of the visiting process are magnified. I know my child will be forced to endure all this, and there is nothing I can do about that ugly truth. The thought of it sends a chill through me. I promise to always watch my little girl's pirouettes and wobbly toe touches every time she asks. It's Christmas Day again. When my wife leaves the visiting room, she's heavy with child. Later that night, at about 3 a.m, I'm notified that she's at the hospital in labor. Best Christmas ever. Hardest Christmas ever. At the California State Prison in Lancaster, we are approaching the new millennium, and panic about the dreaded Y2K computer meltdown has descended on the place. Prisons, of course, exist in a state of constant paranoia, regardless of whether the threats are real or imagined. Every day on the yard, as we get closer to the holidays and the momentous turn of the clocks, the conversations keep edging toward the abyss of irrationality. What if the power goes out? What if the water turns off? This is a possibility, according to alleged experts on the local news, who advise their listeners to keep a 3-day supply on hand, but we assume we'll all die of thirst. No one's coming to save us. Hoarding food has become widespread, particularly those items that stand a chance of lasting a while if the power fails. I'm storing granola bars and bags of nuts under my bunk. I figure I'll be able to last long enough to dig my way out if society collapses on the other side of the fences. I smuggle a couple of 5-gallon buckets into my cell. I'm currently without a bunkmate, so I calculate that 10 gallons of water should hold me for more than a week, enough time to make my escape. The sense of doom pervades every level of the prison. It doesn't help that the governor's recent advice to lifers, at least as it was summarized by one official, is to expect, quote, parole in a pine box. And there is a new iteration of the oldest, most unsettling rumor of all. It is held as a certainty by most prisoners in California that in a time of civil catastrophe, the guards will be detailed to execute all of us in the name of public safety. According to rumor, teams of guards at every prison are now practicing, just in case this liquidation needs to be carried out. When I wake up on January 1st, 2000, the power is still on, the water is still running in the sink, and the fabric of society has managed to hold together. I quietly pour out my 10 gallons of water. No one discusses the events of the past month. Prisoners don't like to admit to feelings of fear. Which isn't to say that the new millennium is a walk in the park. By the end of 2000, the entire prison system looks to be coming apart. From the revolving door leadership of the Department of Corrections in Sacramento to the spate of deadly riots throughout the state. The holidays approach once again, and after years of shrinking, from a full shopping bag of useful items and tasty treats to a small bag of unsalted nuts and broken pieces of candy, the annual present is ended. On the outside, this may seem inconsequential, yet it's an inevitable result of the relentless campaign to dehumanize men and women in prison. It's not a uniquely Californian phenomenon. All across the country, the short-lived reformist impulses of earlier decades are being discarded in favor of a new philosophy of punishment, built on inflicting pain for its own sake. Rarely is this truth even alluded to when we ask about what has happened to the holidays. We can't put up any decorations because someone might be offended. This is one of the most popular excuses, although no one can cite a single instance of offense taken. The costs are prohibitive, which is absurd since the gift bag items were mostly donated, and it doesn't cost a penny to leave the yard open an extra hour or offer eggnog for sale in the canteen. We are all aware that what is really going on with the cancellation of Christmas. It's part of the cancellation of our membership in the family of man. The denial of the holidays, along with the rest of the screw you policies, has unleashed within prisoners a kind of fury that is difficult to contain, hard to direct, and impossible to predict. In the past year, on this yard alone, there have already been 2 skirmishes that each involved dozens of combatants, several stabbings, and 1 full-scale riot of more than 100 men who inundated the guards in a way I'd never experienced in all my 20 years in prison. I don't get visits on Christmas Day anymore either. During the many years that my wife came, telling me she couldn't stand the thought of me being alone on a holiday, I felt blessed. These days, she can't stand the idea of spending a holiday in a prison visiting room. She's not to blame. She fought as hard as anyone could, harder than I could. But the darkness of these places has now succeeded in repelling her too. And yet we are human, whatever the propaganda may say. Our hearts still beat, and the spirit lives on in every breath we take. Under the radar, one glimpses something of that spirit here and there. A few friends who live on the same tier put together the fixings for a nice meal they share on Christmas Eve. Some of the more religious guys defy the ban on grouping to stand together on the yard and sing a carol or two before the guards order them to break it up. 32 Christmases in prison don't leave much room to be surprised, but 2011 brings 2 new experiences. Several years ago, in response to the world's abandonment of prisoners, a few of the guys with their own resources pooled money together and purchased enough goodies to give every man in our building a little gift bag on Christmas Eve. I'm sure no one but a prisoner could have understood the deeper significance of that bag of broken candy or the profoundly dispiriting nature of its loss. I asked those involved if I could contribute to the fund this year. That would be the extent of my participation, I assumed. My 10 bags of chocolate chip cookies from the canteen added to the pot. But here it is, Christmas Eve, and I'm making my way down the tier, putting individually wrapped bags on cell doors, one of Santa's helpers in blue chambray, deep in the joint. This would have been more than enough to make a memorable holiday. A week ago, however, I did something even more personally astonishing. To be clear, I'm a loud man. Of this I am fully aware, as is everyone around me. Men who live down the tier say they can hear my laugh inside their cells while they're wearing headphones. Others have told me they can understand every word of my conversations on the day room phone from 20 yards away in the showers. I had asked one of the religious guys if they would be singing God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen in their upcoming Christmas service. I've always loved its dark, admonitory tone, and can't think of a carol more suitable for a men's prison. I don't know, he tells me. Sing some of it. For some reason I do, loudly and, stranger still, well. Would you sing that at the service? Yes, I will. No one is more surprised by this response than I am. The room where I will be making my singing debut is officially designated as the main sanctuary. It's a term rich in symbolism that I'm sure is lost on the authorities. In ancient times, sanctuaries provided asylum, which made a fugitive immune from arrest. The room is large, about 20 feet by 20 feet, with a stage raised about 6 inches off the floor down in front, like a sawed-off pulpit. The walls are bare and painted in the same institutional off-white as every other room at this prison. There are about 45 individual chairs upholstered in a rough burgundy cloth, and in the corner, a large wooden box that contains a baptismal bathtub. The ceiling is white, water-stained acoustic tile. All in all, it's a remarkably unremarkable space for a sanctuary. On this day, however, there is a riot of holiday colors and ornaments, much of it donated by the old Irish priest, some of it pilfered from the occasional staff celebrations to which we are never invited, and a few pieces the products of our own ingenuity and great longing to see Christmas in our own world. Long streamers of golden tinsel cascade across the walls. At the front, framed in imitation ivy, are several poinsettias with exceptionally lifelike red leaves. The most touching decorations, though, are the simplest. 3 small boxes made out of paper, about 3 inches square. They sit atop the baptismal box. On one, the word faith is written in small, childlike letters. On another is hope, and on the last, in slightly larger letters, love. These are what we've all crowded into this room for, into what is the modern equivalent of the medieval narthex, the place for those deemed unworthy to sit with the good people in the regular pews. And it is love, written with a bit more emphasis, that we all long for most. Without love, as the Apostle Paul warned, we are but a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. So I sing in a room full of my fellow prisoners, decorated with our longings, to louder applause than I could have ever expected. My performance is a success. I am not a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal, but a most imperfect vessel delivering the tidings of joy. I was asked by the religious men to sing the same carol again this year. This is now part of my contribution to the holiday. God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen dates at least to the 16th century, and was first published in the late 17th century, when crime in the crowded streets was rampant, when the hanged bodies of pickpockets were left rotting on display in London as warnings. The treatment of criminals has certainly made great strides since God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen was written. There's still a long way to go, though. The belief that harsh treatment and poor conditions will deter criminality continues to hold sway among a substantial number of people. The failure of this approach has been obvious for centuries, since the days when teams of pickpockets worked the crowds who were watching the hangings of their cohorts. The era of mass incarceration ought to be over. It is not. I'm often asked what I want for Christmas. People tend to send books and music. I get cards and I send cards. I hang up some decorations and try to enjoy the holiday-themed entertainment, what there is of it. I plan for the inevitable lockdowns so that I'll have something useful and diverting to do for the day. I remember the times when I was in the visiting room with Anita and my daughter Alia, without bitterness. I try, to the best of my abilities, to have as normal an experience as possible. What I really want, of course, I can't have. I want to stay up late on Christmas Eve, arranging my daughter's presents on the same old chair for both of us to enjoy, just as my father did for me. I want to attend a family gathering and share a meal with the people I've been estranged from for more than 3 decades. I want to breathe the air of a free man. I want, most of all, for the atrocious mistakes of my past to vanish so that I can wake up in a cold sweat next to my wife in our bed, thanking God that all this was but a horrible nightmare of Christmases that never happened, that the life I lead is a good and worthy one after all. But because these are all far too much to ask for, and because I know that, I wish only for another reasonably good performance singing that old carol. I pray that my voice doesn't quake too loudly or waver, and that my eyes don't water up too obviously when I sing the words, "To save us all from Satan's power when we were gone astray."
Hello, you are still listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM, broadcasting live. That was an audio version of a piece written by Kenneth E. Hartman, who is still imprisoned in California. You can find out more about Kenneth by visiting his website, kennethehartman.com.
That was a mashup of the carols Carols of the Bells and God Rest You Merry Gentlemen. The song was a dedication to someone named Benoit. Merry Christmas, Benoit. Your friends are thinking of you. Next, we're going to share with you an interview with Tanya Dubot-Gaudreau from the group All Prisoners Are Political. Tanya talked to us about conditions in Tanguay, the women's provincial prison here on the island of Montreal.
You were recently released from Tanguay, which is the provincial prison for women on the island of Montreal. Can you start off talking of the conditions women in Tanguay are facing right now, including things like what is the food like and what are the conditions of the building itself?
Yeah, first of all, the food is clearly not sustainable. The classical Tanguay meal is composed of 2 tablespoons of overcooked frozen veggies, 2 small pieces of potatoes, and a stew-style sauce with 2 small pieces of meat. That or rice with almost nothing on it. They give us bread through the day, but not enough for the average of 35 women by wing that we are. For the same reason, fight for a glass of milk or pieces of bread happen often. The pregnant woman diet includes a few salted crackers, 2 slices of processed cheese, and an apple. That's not enough. The sanitary situation is a big issue. We are in the impossibility of cleaning our wings properly. Add to that the accumulation of dirt to just keep building up. Don't forget that we are stuck with people with severe withdrawal syndrome who shit and puke everywhere and cannot stop it, due in part to the failing medical services, which access can take up to a week and a half. The prisoners have to take care of them without glove or enough Javix and soap, what we are often lacking. The soap they give us is bright red when they receive it and light pink when giving to the girls in the wings. The chance to contract hepatitis is pretty high. The building itself is falling apart. Sewage got through the drinking water pipe in the max sector.
While you were in Tanguay, women there released a statement connecting austerity and conditions in the prison. Can you talk a bit about austerity and how you would define it? And also, how is austerity connected to the conditions prisoners are facing in Tanguay?
The degradation of the life condition in Tanguay are directly linked to the austerity measure and the cut has been made by the government in the carceral complex. We are conscient of that fact. The idea to put the denunciation about the specific situation was happening in Tanguay in larger perspective with the austerity question is mostly to open the struggle to every prison, every prisoner who are in disagreement with those and their effect. It is also in the perspective to get the workers and the students who also have an interest in that struggle against austerity to organize in collaboration with us, to organize a real struggle where other social class will be involved. This is how a real social strike will be done. Plus, the jail population, who is a part of the poorest social class in Quebec, is touched by the austerity measure in many different ways. The social assistance, the communitary services, food bank, etc. Those cuts make us even more poor than we already are. The jail's condition is only one of the ways we fill those cuts. This is why it is so important to insist on the denunciation of all of the austerity measure. The struggle we're now starting about the jail condition is only a start of what should be made.
The statement from women in Tanguay included demands for basic necessities, adequate and nutritious food, follow-up care for pregnant women, care for people going through withdrawal, adequate provision of sanitary products, access to social programming, job training, and therapy. Can you talk about these demands? And do you see them as similar to demands being made in other communities fighting against austerity? And then how are they unique to women prisoners in a provincial prison?
Those demands are mostly the respect of the basic human needs. Food, decent shelter, health, safety. Better life condition will also increase the level of the person's security. Decent access to food and hygiene product will decrease the violence level between the prisoners, which is increased in the prison conditions. Also, when you are not sentenced, the sole population problem hit a lot more. It takes an average of 1 month to get a cell, which you have to spend watching your bags without going out, stressing while taking a shower. Space to store our stuff is a necessity. The fact that they cut the right to smoke is also an issue. Tanguay women did write a petition to the new federal government about that, and by the way, I give them my congrats for their mobilization. 98% of the incarcerated people are smokers while they got arrested. The lack of nicotine also make the violence rate to increase. All our revendications are really alike the ones the male prisoners must have. The only thing is that right now the conditions are worse in the women's jail because in the past they didn't mobilize themselves on little things, so the situation fell apart faster and further, especially with the moving to Leclerc. But women now are realizing it and will pursue the fight to get the same condition and advantage in them. They also talk about closing Tanguy because of budget economy. They want to move the girls to the Leclerc Detention Center, which will be shared with the guys. Even the correctional agent union are against the move because they're afraid that the degradation of life condition implies with the move will increase the risk for their personal safety. They will move the girls there without any renovation or new management. The only services following is the pastoral services. No more zootherapy, art therapy, clothes services or job available. They are talking to do it in March. The mobilization will be important to try to get better condition over there.
Do you know how long they're talking about having the women stay in Leclerc?
Always.
Okay. So you're a part of this new committee that has been created on the outside called All Prisoners Are Political. Do you want to tell our listeners what this new committee is all about? What are its goals and plans? And then maybe if you want, try and answer some of these bigger questions of how can people on the outside better support struggles happening inside prison, and how can people organizing against austerity on the outside make more connections with prisoners organizing against austerity?
Our group called All Detention is Politic defend the interests of the incarcerated people in the struggle against austerity. We are there to help and support them while they are organizing themselves for a better life condition in jail and against austerity, as well to assume a role in the activist movement to organize a larger struggle against austerity. We are doing that double task in a perspective of social strike. We also build ourselves to be a political and material support to any person who gets incarcerated in link with that struggle. We also have an educational purpose, which involves to distribute political material of all tendencies into the jail population, but also to the outside people who don't necessarily have access to it. It is also included to make the activist movement know about how are the life conditions of the poorest people and not only those who are in jail. We also engage ourselves to develop on all the theoretical questions linked to the prisoner struggle, like why are all detention politic, the abolition of prison, develop on what is the lumpen proletariat, what is the role of the illegal economy and the capitalist system, which role play the carceral system into all that, etc.
I think that's it from our questions. Kay. Do you have anything that you wanted to add?
Yeah. Okay. I want to say hello to Angie, Mo, Vicky, Sarah, Christine, Nino, Ariana, and Joanne. Les filles, le combat ne fait que commencer. Joyeux Noël. And by the way, every prisoner can contact us to the follow address, 2033 Saint Laurent Street, Montreal, Quebec, H2X2T3.
That was Tania Dubot-Gaudreau from the group All Prisoners Are Political here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. The time is currently 10 to noon, and you can also be listening to us on cable at 91.7 and CKUT.ca. Don't forget that next Thursday, December 31st, is Montreal's annual New Year's Eve noise demonstration. People are encouraged to come out to Metro Henri Bourassa on the corner of La Jeunesse and Boulevard Henri Bourassa at 4:30 p.m. There will be a bus to transport people out to the prisons in Laval to say Happy New Year's from across the prison walls.
Vix, this next song is a request from Tanya, who we just heard from.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. De pie cantar que vamos a triunfar. Avanzan ya banderas de unidad. Y tú vendrás marchando junto a mí. Y así verás tu canto y tu bandera. Anuncia
La patria está forjando la unidad, de norte a sur se movilizará. Se alza en la lucha con voz de gigante, gritando adelante. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. 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 El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
You're listening to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. You can check out past episodes of The Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, January 14th, 2016. There may be a New Year's Eve special next week, so you should tune in on December 31st at 5 p.m. and see what's going on. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved in the show, you can contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message for us on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. And if you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. I just wanted to end our show today by saying happy holidays and all that to our listeners inside. We couldn't do this show without you. Spending the holidays inside is pretty terrible, and we wanted to say that we're thinking of all of you today and a bunch in the next week or so. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we've been your hosts for today, and we're going to end with a song from Metallica. Thank you.
my brain, assuring me that I'm insane. They think I'm